to the L. Barrio, you know we got flow. East Harlem, home of the Bogner Show. Listen, podcast dishing, easy going. On the show where the hot air's always blowing. Downloading, never miss an episode. Keep it real, always serve it Alamo. New York, New York, if you can make it here, you know the rest, you can make it anywhere.
This is episode 89 of the Brad Bogner Show. Our guest today is Yoan Grillo, journalist, writer, and author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Thanks for joining the show today. Great to have you.
Good to be here, Brad.
And now, I guess I just want to get this out of the way right up front. I didn't get permission from the cartel to talk to you. Am I okay, or is my entire family's life in danger right now?
I think you're fine, yeah. I think no problem with you at all.
All right, that's good to get that out of the way. I just figured I owed it to my loved ones to just give them a heads up or something like that, you know?
Okay, yeah. I think you're okay, but a lot of journalists are having a bad time. I mean, have you seen the news in the last few months, a series of attacks on journalists here in Mexico? The area de Juarez in Ciudad Juarez was attacked with gunfire. A journalist was killed up in also in Chihuahua State in the town of Ojinaga. El Siglo de Torreón has been attacked several times in the last month. So yes, it's certainly a grim situation for many journalists around Mexico are covering this issue.
I thought that's what was so interesting right off the bat is how you mentioned you moved from England, you come to Mexico, you were inspired, you said, by the movie Salvador from Oliver Stone, and I thought that was pretty respectable. You know, I saw like Full Metal Jacket at an early age, and I wasn't inspired to join the military. But that's pretty cool that you're interested in, you know, getting into that ground level and almost trench warfare at this rate.
That's right. When I saw the movie Salvador, and I was very fascinated by the character played by James Woods, of a war photographer who'd also been in Vietnam and then ended up in covering the Salvadoran War back in the 80s. And it was, very fascinating to me. But when I first arrived in Mexico in 2000, it was a very different scenario when I first arrived. These Central American wars of the 80s, which all the veteran correspondents that I met had covered, had all finished. And it was meant to be a new era of democracy and freedom and the free market when these things had finished.
And that's what I guess was interesting, is you came there right for the changing of the guard. You know, the PRI party in Mexico had controlled the Mexican politics for so many decades, and then, you know, guys like Vicente Fox come on board and they say, we're going to, you know, kind of clean up this whole drug trade, and that's sort of when things got out of control.
Yes. It was kind of crept up gradually. The new democracy happened, the National Action Party power under Vicente Fox in a time of hope and optimism after the end of 71 years of one-party rule. And little by little, the stories of drug trafficking violence, drug-related violence, cartel violence, crept up and got bigger and bigger. And it started really around 2004 in the city of Nuevo Laredo, which is just over the border from Laredo, Texas. And there was a fight there between the Sinaloa cartel and the Gulf cartel with the new armed enforcement wing at the time, the CETAS, over that territory, which is a real drug trafficking fire hose. A lot of drugs moving north into Texas, and then from there they could go to the whole eastern seaboard. They go from Texas to Atlanta and then up to New York and so forth. So that first began, the kind of first explosion in this kind of modern episode in intense drug trafficking violence happened there. And I was working for the Houston Chronicle, so I was very interested in the story and what was happening on the Texas border. And I was sent there to try and make sense of what was going on. And I saw really a kind of a laboratory for the violence that would then spread across Mexico.
And I guess the Mexican politicians kind of picked up on some American politician cues, guys like Nixon and Reagan that had these strong anti-drug stances. That ended up being very big in terms of political wins, raising the funds to kind of combat these sorts of things.
Well, under Vicente Fox, There was an effort to fight organized crime and drug cartels, but it wasn't the central piece of his administration. But really, when Felipe Calderón took power, and he took power in December 2006, and there was this problem with escalating drug-related violence, and he adopted the central policy of kind of war on drugs or war on drug cartels. And in some ways, I feel that followed the politics of Richard Nixon or Ronald Reagan. In the, both of them, you know, Nixon had his war on drugs as a central policy, and he saw it being very effective politics. You fight and talk tough words against this enemy who can't answer back, drugs, make these seizures and arrests and so forth. And generally, it helped with his approval ratings and helped with his re-election. And Ronald Reagan, when in 1982, you know, he had the South Florida Task Force Against Drugs and launched the Miami Cocaine Cowboys. Again, a kind of similar logic. So Felipe Calderón had that historical experience that you could fight against his enemy. Now, Felipe Calderón, when he took power, had other issues to deal with as well. He'd only won power by less than 1% of the vote in the closest election in Mexican history. And his rival, who he beat, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, accused him of robbing the election, accused him of fraud, and had massive demonstrations in Mexico City. So when Felipe Calderón took power, one way to assert himself, say, you know, the new sheriff in town, I'm here, was to say, I'm going to have a, you know, a very decisive war against these drug cartels and a military offensive. And he launched the soldiers against drug cartels in more than 13 states across Mexico. At its peak of Calderón's offensive, there were 96,000 soldiers active fighting drug cartels across Mexico, as well as about 15,000 Marines. So he took these efforts to a new level, but that caused a massive escalation, or it coincided with a massive escalation of drug-related violence.
And when you mention that drug violence escalation too, I mean, it just seems so shocking because you got 2006, Calderón takes over. 2008, I remember at one point in the book you mentioned there's 500 murders per month. And it's just, you know, complete impunity. They're going after police officers, politicians, public officials, even women and children. Broad daylight, just very brazen, violent attacks.
Yeah, I mean, at the worst year of drug-related violence appears to be 2011. It's very hard to know the numbers. It's very hard to really know when, you know, drug-related violence is occurring and so forth. But the worst year appears to be 2011. It was more than 1,000 drug-related killings a month or killings related to drug cartels and security forces sent against them. And yeah, you're right. I mean, it really got beyond the pale. That was one of the problems with this escalation of violence. Violence was used as a form of propaganda, as a way to try and spread terror, to form the government to back off, try and force the government to back off, or also to try and confront their enemies. And this drug-related violence really, the terror tactics got worse and worse. Sorry, I stumbled a bit there, I was just driving, and that was like the words were a little bit shaky.
Oh, no, no, we came, yeah.
I raised this bit in the edit, and I'll pick up my thread. So what I wanted to say was the drug-related violence really got out of hand, it really got beyond the pale. And the cartels began to use terror tactics against each other and against the government. And these terror tactics were to say various things. When they're talking to the government, they're trying to tell the government to back off. When they're talking to rival cartels or the street, they're trying to say they were the most powerful act in town and people must back them. So you've got this incredible escalation. I mean, decapitation was not a big deal in Mexico. It was not really done in Mexico much before 2006. The first incident, two policemen had their heads cut off. Then there was five heads rolled into a disco dance floor. Then later we saw 12 decapitated heads, and that seemed a big deal. I remember that in 2008. And then we saw 18. And then I went last year to cover 49 decapitated bodies that had been dumped on a road. So quite extraordinary things happening. And as you say, civilians often caught up in this. Now, some of the time, it seemed that people were literally grabbed off the street to make up the numbers in these massacres. They would just grab waiters leaving restaurants and kidnap them and decapitate them so that they could fit in these acts of terror. And also, you know, civilians killed for a number of reasons. You know, I've talked to people who were killed, they were just simply innocent bystanders. You know, they at these places and they were fired at, or they were mistaken identities, or someone they had crossed somebody connected to a cartel and ended up on a hit list. So, yeah, very dangerous situation where violence really went beyond the pale.
And even more insane is that so many of these, you think of these cartels as much older adults, and a lot of these are children committing these terror acts, these violent acts, 13, 14-year-olds, you know, carrying out assassinations, doing all these things. And, you know, they come from these poor backgrounds. They don't really have jobs or families. And, I mean, you say at one point they're getting hired for like $85 to just straight up murder people, which seemed crazy.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. As this conflict escalated, the cartels recruited all kinds of people. So whereas initially, you know, boy, we're going back to the 1990s, most of the hitmen would be these kind of seasoned professional gunmen. They would just be recruiting their combatants from all over the country. So they would be grabbing from the slums of Ciudad Juarez, from country villages, you know, gang members, teenagers. And as you say, some of them would be just $85 for a hit, which shows real deterioration in the society. It shows in these neighbors that young men could do that. And I went into many of these neighbors and interviewed these young gang members and the people who are in the youth prisons to try to understand how they could do this. And one thing that really struck me was how they were recruited into these cartels, often very early, doing simpler jobs. They were recruited in doing jobs such as spies, lookouts on street corners, how they would be carrying packages, and then they'd be kind of bought into it, and gradually their level of really, you know, accepting what they would do would get less and less. You know, once they became involved in the cartel, there's kind of no turning back. And the problem was that nobody else was coming to these neighborhoods and offering these kids anything. You know, I would go and speak to these kids, and they didn't seem like bad people. They didn't seem like evil people. They seemed like perfectly all right human beings, but the state was offering them nothing. I mean, in these neighborhoods that had really been left behind, that there were often not even paved roads, sometimes, you know, no chance of jobs. And they saw no future for themselves apart from, you know, joining these cartels. So that was one of the kind of fundamental problems that fueled this war. And then some of the assassins were 13, 14-year-olds, you know, young, very young children would then be brought into the ranks and swept up in this violence.
Another thing that was, you trace the violence as going towards the ability for the cartels to just go across the border into America and buying these high powerful weapons, you know, semi-automatic rifles, RPGs. And, you know, it was interesting that for $100, they could have somebody buy them a gun and then use that same gun, and only $85 to kill the person. So it is sort of this kind of revolving door of also that, you know, a lot of these guys were in the police force, in the military, and they just get, you know, basically recruited to join these cartels. And it seems like that's going to be kind of tough to break up, I guess.
That's another big issue. I mean, you mentioned several important issues there. The issue of guns coming from the United States has been a big part of this problem. The violence really began to escalate, like I said, in 2004. Now, as you know, that was the same year that the assault rifles ban was revoked in the United States. And many of those guns for this conflict come from the U.S. They're AR-15 or AK-47 assault rifles bought in U.S. stores. Both those rifles are available. AK-47, many of them are manufactured in Europe or in China. They're sold across Texas and Arizona. And then brought down here to Mexico and used in a bunch of killings. Now, the Mexican government's asked repeatedly, you know, can the U.S. do something to stop the flow of rifles? And it's asked, and the U.S. has said it will try, and it has tried and failed. And that pipeline of guns is intact. It stays intact today. So, you know, people say, well, if they didn't have the guns from the U.S., they'd have them from somewhere else. that might be true, but it could slow the violence if the guns were not so readily available, so cheap, and the ammunition so cheap. Now, the style of killings here, often there were attackers seen. I've been to many murder scenes here where they've sprayed 300 to 500 bullets at the victim. So that shows they have an incredible amount of ammunition to fire. And if, again, if the ammunition, if it was somehow slowed down, it was not so readily available, that could save lives as well. You also mentioned, though, the problem of corruption. Again, is very, very true. Mexico is an extremely corrupt country. Many of the assassins themselves, and I interviewed one guy in a prison cell, being a former policeman, and gone from being a policeman to being a drug cartel assassin. So that is a big issue here. How do you deal with corruption? How do you stop it from really being trained as police or soldiers and then going over to the cartels? And that's a problem that has to continue. I mean, Mexico really has to hammer away at trying to build a stronger police force, or we have to really look at stopping the fundamental cause of the drug money coming down to Mexico.
So what I thought was so interesting about the cartel was how many similarities it had to Al Capone and Prohibition. You know, this idea, people clearly wanted something that was banned, these complicated networks and systems that just put the leaders so hard to, you know, basically prosecute. And I guess what was interesting was Joaquin Guzman, leader of the Sinaloa cartel, has recently been declared the public enemy number one in Chicago, the first time they've given that designation since Al Capone.
Yeah, but I mean, there's obviously a whole host of comparisons, and those comparisons are useful. I think you can see many of the failures of prohibition of alcohol have been repeated in the prohibition of drugs, of narcotics. And obviously the way that the sales and this industry of legal drug sales have produced these criminal bosses. However, in other things, that the comparisons are weak, and in the fact that the Mexican drug violence is far, far worse than anything in Chicago in the 1920s. I mean, we still talk about the St. Valentine's Day massacre of Al Capone, in that they killed seven people. And in a single massacre in Mexico by the Zetas, allegedly, by the town of San Fernando in 2010, they killed 72 people in a single massacre. So that, you know, shows the scale of violence here. Well, that was one massacre, 72. Another massacre of 49 people took place. There's been mass graves or series of mass pits with more than 300 corpses. You know, groups of 50 guys with RPGs, AK-47s, belt of machine guns, ambushing military convoys, attacking police bases, kidnapping police officers en masse, victims en masse. So it's absolutely crazy things that have been more comparable to war zones. But on the other side, this kind of gangster element, similar to the Al Capone days of Chicago.
Because that's what was interesting, was that, you know, it's primarily in Mexico. And yet now that Chicago's sitting there worried about a guy who's probably never actually been in the area, he's already getting a lot of attention. And he actually, I think there were rumors that Guzman had been executed, but I guess rumors of his demise were greatly exaggerated.
Yeah, well, the first part of what you were talking about, you know, being in Chicago and President of Chicago, I mean, this has always been a story where the United States has been involved massively. There's always been Mexican drug cartel emissaries operating in the United States. It's always been the money of the United States drug users funding these cartels. It's always been the policies of the United States government of prohibition and of fighting this conflict in the trafficking and producing countries, which has created the parameters or been part of laying down the parameters of this conflict. There's always been United States firearms, you know, guns manufactured in factories in the United States, or guns that have been manufactured in Europe or the Far East and sold in the United States, that have been going, you know, and supplying a large part of the arsenals for these cartels. So the United States has always been part of this battleground and so forth. And you know, many of these people obviously going there, operating in the United States. You know, it's very interesting how you know, you can buy drugs in all 50 states in the US. So, you know, there's this trying to fight to stop production and trafficking here, where it is very easy to find drugs. I mean, I was making a documentary about this, and I was in Phoenix, Arizona, and I wanted to see how quickly it would take to find some crystal meth in Phoenix, Arizona. We just drove in there. It took me about 10 minutes to find someone who was selling crystal meth. Asked a couple of people, hang around in one of the squares there, a couple of kind of homeless people hanging out, and before I knew it, they kind of had crystal meth crack and they were showing us and whatever. So, you know, it shows that drugs are moving all around the place there. Talking about Chapo Guzman himself and this, you get to these mythical type figures of the drug kingpins, you know, somewhere between rock stars and terrorists, you know, these people, and who are they, where are they, rumors all the time that they suddenly appearing in a restaurant and closing down the house and paying for everyone's meals. And suddenly, you know, a rumor came recently that he died in a shootout in Guatemala, which was turned out not to be true. There was a myth last year or a rumor last year that they were almost got him in Los Cabos and they were seconds away, maybe they weren't. So yeah, I mean, you know, quite extraordinary figures. These figures do exist. These figures do have a lot of wealth and a lot of power. However, sometimes the role of some of these godfather figures can be exaggerated. At the end of the day, it's a whole industry. It's operating with loads of mid-level operatives. I mean, Chapo Guzman himself is a powerful, emblematic drug trafficker. But his drug trafficking networks operate because of loads of mid-level people, low-level people, people directly below him who are running and are running this industry all the time, from the people who are growing coca leaves, processing it, moving it along the way, to the people selling it on the streets. There's thousands and thousands of people in this industry. And I mean, whatever, like any industry, I mean, you can change CEOs, the industry still runs.
I guess, yeah, that was a very interesting part. And those drug wars that were heating up 5 or 6 years ago, the book mentions, yeah, it's almost like these figureheads, they get knocked out and there's just somebody else to take their place and business as usual continues.
That's right. I mean, it's a big machine, a big industry. You can follow it. It keeps on ticking around 24/7 as we're speaking now. There's new coca leaves that are being grown. There's new cocaine being, bricks of cocaine being made in factories.
One thing that was interesting was the book mentions how the United Nations pretty much demands all participating nations to pledge prohibitionist policies on drugs. Is that something you find kind of a non-issue, or is that actually potentially holding up real reform or help on the way, I guess?
I think it's a very big issue, and I think, yes, it is holding up reform. It's interesting, the United Nations treaties, there's a succession of treaties by the United Nations that all signatories have to prohibit drugs. Now, a lot of these were put in when the US had a very gung-ho policy in favor of prohibition. These are times, during the 1960s and 70s and so forth, and we saw under the government of Richard Nixon where the United States was leading the charge in the world on prohibition, and going all the way back to the time of the very first kind of Harrison's the Harrison's Narcotic Tax Act in 1914. Back then, again, it had it was leading the charge in prohibition. Now it's funny, the US is now really in some ways a leading figure on drug policy reform, with the legalization of marijuana in Colorado and in Washington State. Now that legalization there contravenes United Nations treaties. Now it's funny, the reaction of that from a lot of Americans when they hear that, and I've seen this responding to articles I've written, they're saying, God, we don't care what the United Nations, there's no way we're going to let the United Nations dictate to us what our drug policy should be. But it is interesting, when Holland has attempted over the years to liberalize the sale of marijuana, then again the United Nations has hassled Holland on that, and that's why Holland has left it this kind of legally ambiguous situation. In Holland, it's not actually legal to sell marijuana. It's kind of a tolerated, ambiguous thing that they kind of let them get away with it, selling it in these coffee shops. So I think, yeah, it is very important to revise those treaties. Now, there's talk now in 2016 of a new United Nations summit which will address drug policy and these treaties. Now, perhaps by that time they could revise them, perhaps take marijuana out of them, perhaps go even further. But yes, I think it is holding up, and it is needed to change those to move forward in drug policy.
Vicente Fox, the person you've interviewed a couple years ago, and he's actually somebody who's done a 180 since he was in office, and he actually seems to support full drug legalization. Now, while El Narco wasn't entirely, you know, a case for or against drug legalization, is that kind of something you're going to see more politicians of, whether it be Mexico or not, that are kind of pushing for more drug legalization?
Most definitely, yeah. We've seen a sea change in this the last 3 or 4 years. For a long time, politicians were very scared to go anywhere near the idea of drug legalization. They saw that as being a toxic issue that they couldn't touch. And the kind of wisdom, you know, was always, oh, this is a non-starter. We can't even go there. And if I start saying legalization, if I start, you know, I'm somehow seen as somebody who is an advocate of drugs, you know, as being a, you know, a junkie myself or something. But that's changed a lot. And we've seen, we first saw a lot of ex-presidents. So we saw, you know, this move when a couple of years ago, when the ex-president Vicente Fox, there was a document put out by Ernesto Zedillo, Gaviria of Colombia, and Cardoso of Brazil, where they all said, we know that, you know, the war on drugs has been a failure. It hasn't worked. Vicente Fox then came out, and then we've seen some sitting presidents right now. We've seen Otto Perez of Guatemala, very interesting, who was a military figure. You know, everyone was expecting him to be more hardline. He came in power, and he came out with quite a strong line critical of the prohibition of drugs and saying we need to rethink this. And he was a leading figure of the Summit of the Americas about this in Cartagena. Now, and also seeing Santos in Colombia. We're seeing now Mojia in Uruguay. And these politicians are seeing that rather than being a toxic issue, it's actually a very useful issue of them. It gives them presence on the international stage. And now they're seeing it actually gives them, allies them with a cause that many, many people are in favor of. So I think that we're seeing a sea change there. Now in the US, we've seen congressmen introduce a bill to legalize or to allow states to legalize marijuana. So I think a big change in that, and we'll see more and more politicians coming openly behind drug policy reform in the coming years.
Very interesting. And I guess to wrap it up on kind of a lighter note, you said while studying, interviewing, writing and talking to all these people, the one constant thing they seem to be inspired by and love so much was the movie Scarface. And I always thought it was a pretty bad movie. Is there any hope that they'll at least be inspired by something better in the future?
Well, Scarface is an iconic movie. And yes, I remember one case. I went to a prison. The police were raiding after a guy there had been killed who was the head of a group of criminals in the prison and of convicted drug traffickers, basically a cartel aligned guy there. And he had a massive poster of Al Pacino in Scarface. It certainly hits home with many drug traffickers. Also, I mentioned this guy who was a DEA agent who went as undercover, and he was also a fan of the movie Scarface. So it's kind of both sides of the divide. A lot of people like that movie. If they'd be inspired by better movies, well, we'll see if better movies are made about this. I think in English, in my opinion, there hasn't been a great movie about Mexican drug traffickers made. That's something which maybe we'll get made in the future.
Yeah, I kind of started seeing that. There was this movie, End of Watch, that was kind of about the Sinaloa cartel kind of invading into Los Angeles. And I really ruined the movie experience, I think, for everybody I watch it with, because I was trying to repeat everything from your book. And I hope I got all the details right, at least.
Well, glad to see that I'm ruining some movie watching there. But yeah, I think there's been a few attempts. I haven't seen that one, End of Watch. I could check it out. I saw Savages, the film. I thought the book was excellent. The fictional book was excellent. I thought the movie was okay. It didn't really become a great movie about this. I think it lacked in several ways. There's been a movie, La Linea, which I didn't really think was a great movie. But there's been various attempts, and I don't think anyone's really really nailed it, and it is a complicated issue to nail. I think the best movie about Mexican drug cartels is a Mexican film, El Infierno, Mexico 2010 is called, and that's a satire, which I think it's a very good film about the whole situation. I think it captures a lot of the essence of it there.
I guess what we have movies, there was a great story about you talking to a undercover federal agent who saw Michael Mann, who's one of my favorite directors. He saw his new movie, Miami Vice, happened to be very similar to the scene operation he was running, and he was pretty much convinced he was going to be dead.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, it's interesting how movies emulate reality and reality emulates movies, and that's never been so true with the Mexican drug conflict. In that case, he saw that, and he saw that in the film they were using a sting that he was using. It was a sting of going to the cartels, and in that case he was with the Colombian cartels. In Miami Vice, also talked about approaching the Colombian cartels and saying to them, "We'll transport your drugs for you so that we can then seize your drugs." And that's exactly what he was doing in Panama City, meeting Colombian cartel people to take their cocaine. Although the movie was in the cinemas, they still went for it, and they gave him more than 3 tons of cocaine, which he took on a ship, and they busted it. So he got away with that. They lost millions and millions of dollars. But yeah, we had other things. I remember watching an episode of Breaking Bad. This is something I cite in my book as well. Watching an episode of Breaking Bad where they had an IED in Ciudad Juarez. In the episode of Breaking Bad, they had a decoy, which was a head on a turtle, on a giant turtle. And I thought, well, that's a bit unrealistic. They don't use IEDs in Ciudad Juarez. And I was thinking that. And then in the real Ciudad Juarez, they did use an IED with a decoy, in fact, as well. So quite similar to the Breaking Bad episode. So I don't know. I don't want to say that they were inspired by Breaking Bad. They probably had these designs anyway. But it's interesting how sometimes fiction can actually lead reality in these things. And some very surreal, tragic episodes, but very surreal. I know another author here who wrote a book called Among Dogs, about a fictional book about the situation. Here in the book, he had some gangsters put a head of a dog on the body of a person. And he thought, kind of gruesome scene. And in reality, that actually, as he was writing the book, in reality, as he did it, they put a head of a pig on the body of a person. So again, some very, very gruesome things. It's hard to compete with the very disturbed criminal imagination in this drug conflict.
Definitely not. And the book is El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Yolan, thank you very much for being on the show, and best of luck to you going forward.
Thank you very much. All the best, Brad.
Yes, thank you. Have a good one.
Will do. Cheers, then. Take care.